Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. It's a great pleasure to see you all here. Although, as always with this topic, on a somber occasion, because here we are, 30 years or so after humanity began its conversation with this weird and desperately ill-understood epidemic. And we've now reached the point where that conversation has acquired both many dimensions and, in consequence, many questions which ordinary people want to get the answer to. It's been surrounded with a huge amount of misunderstanding and mythology. After all, any sort of health issue that sits in the middle of a vortex of the three things that you don't discuss at dinner, power and sex and race, is going to be extraordinarily difficult to research well and to understand. But that's what we're going to try and do here this evening. This lecture series, and this lecture in particular, is sponsored by the Department for International Development. We're very, very grateful to them for their support, and we're very delighted to welcome several of our colleagues from the department who are here with us in the audience tonight. And the lectures, because you're going to get two, you get two for the price of one, the lectures are under the auspice of LSE AIDS. LSE AIDS is a research unit within the university, part of DESTIN, and it brings together those who have interests in AIDS and AIDS-related questions across the whole school, and it's directed by one of tonight's lecturers, Tony Barnett. Our purpose here is for a somber subject, but it's also a moment of celebration because we're here to welcome the publication of this. You will, of course, not be allowed to leave the school until you've bought your copies outside, but don't worry, you'll be able to get them for 20% off. I thought you'd like to make that.
Very well done.
Thank you.
Where you did it.
Excellent, Tony. Thank you very much. There really isn't. No, no. If you're going to do the hard sell, you might as well do it that way. But this is the second edition. It says, in case you have any doubts, that it's fully revised and updated. It says it on the cover, so it must be true. It is, actually. I've seen it inside. But it's the second edition of a book which has, in its first edition, been a bestseller, and for good reason. Because given the baffling nature of the epidemic, there's been always a crying need for somewhere to which people could turn that was going to be cool and authoritative and comprehensive. And Alan and Tony, in writing AIDS in the 21st Century, actually provided that in the first edition. The information has amassed and developed since that first edition, 2002, and so now we have the second edition before us this evening. However, whilst you're, of course, all going to buy it before you leave, don't worry, you'll know what it says before you leave the lecture room, because we have the two authors who are going to be giving back-to-back lectures, one after the other. The questions, please keep from the first lecture till the end of the second, and then we'll have a discussion period after that. The first lecture is going to be given by Alan Whiteside, sitting here on my right. Alan is the director of HERD, the Health Economics and AIDS Research Division of the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and, in the view of many of us, the most effective research institute on these subjects south of the equator. Alan has been in this field for much longer than most people, and certainly well before it was fashionable. He was, if you'll forgive the pun, leading the herd, when the herd didn't yet know that it wanted to gallop into the field. I think that in creating HERD and in the work that he did early in the exploration of the epidemic, sparing his blushes, he's a person who, along with Jonathan Mann, has had a particularly important seminal role in opening up our understanding of AIDS. And so we're extremely lucky to have him here with us this evening in the LSE. I might also say we're extremely lucky in a wider sense, because in the newly created centre that's going to be looking at all forms of long-wave events, of which HIV/AIDS is one, Alan is going to be becoming a visiting fellow in the Mackinder Centre that's just been opened in the school. So I'm delighted to be able to mention that. And he will then be followed by Tony Barnett. Tony, the director of LSE AIDS and the associate director of the McKinley Center for the Study of Long Wave Events, has also been very long in the field of studying AIDS. He conducted one of the very first fieldwork studies on the epidemic in Rakai in Uganda in the 1980s. In 1990, for the ODA, he published AIDS in Africa. He's an eminent and widely quoted scholar. And so the two of them having come together, Palgrave have now facilitated for all of us the opportunity to take this away for your bedtime reading, but it's not bedtime yet. The lectures come first. And the first lecture is going to be given by Alan. And Alan, the floor is yours.
Thank you for your kind words, Sir Gwyn. It's a pleasure to be here at the LSE to see friends and colleagues that I've known for some time. It's really nice to see you here. Of course, Gwyn and Tony both need to take some responsibility for what I'm about to say, because they both taught me, which means they're terribly, terribly old. In the case of Gwyn, rather older than Tony, because he taught me when I was at school in Swaziland, which is an awfully long time ago. So, so I'm afraid you played a role in my formative years, so you have to take some responsibility for what I'm about to say. The other thing... That's true. The other thing, which Gwyn was actually a child prodigy. I think he was 16 when he came and taught in Swaziland. Does that help, Gwyn? The other thing which I want to say is that bestseller in academic terms doesn't mean a huge amount. I think it's anything over 1,500. Move over Dale Brown. I would love to be on the bestseller list on in other terms, but I fear that won't happen, particularly not with this subject. And why? Well, because it's not fashionable. And I suspect that, as we're going to see over the next little while, HIV and AIDS will become less fashionable. And that's actually quite a tragedy, because it is probably, next to global warming, one of the key areas that we need to be concerned about as we look at this century that we're now entering. And what I'm going to do in this presentation is to focus on just four key messages, but they're going to be interspersed in what I say, so pay attention now, and if you want to take notes, this is a good moment to do it. The first one is that AIDS has been here for 25 years, and it's going to be about for a lot longer. I would say that the youngest person in this audience, if you start working on this now, it is something you could still be working on when you reach retirement, which in my case isn't all that long, and in Gwyn's place is even sooner. So I think that it really is important to understand that this is going to be around for a long time. The second thing, it isn't a global challenge. Let's be clear on that. There are parts of the world where AIDS isn't a problem, and it won't be a problem, and it doesn't matter. But there are parts of the world where it's a huge issue and it's going to get worse. And that is particularly the case for where I come from, which is Southern Africa. The third key message that I want to carry forward into the lecture is that it's extremely complex. I don't even begin to understand what this epidemic is and what it's doing. I'm just grappling with some of the ideas that I'll present to you this evening. And finally, it's not just about health. This is about development. It's about how we don't do development. It's about how we ought to do development. It's about where we failed with development. This is a multi-sectoral, or mainstreaming, or whatever you wish to call it. It is more than a health issue. So what I'm going to say is under these four sections. I'm going to talk about why Southern Africa. I'm going to give you a brief history of what's been happening in my part of the world. I'm going to talk about where we are in terms of the epidemic in Southern Africa today. I'll touch briefly on some of the prospects, and I want to end off by asking perhaps a slightly controversial question, which will neatly, I hope, segue into Tony's presentation. Was it inevitable? Because it may well be that this epidemic was inevitable, and it may well be that what we face in the future is inevitable, but maybe not. Maybe we can learn from HIV and AIDS. So why Southern Africa? Well, when Tony and I sat and talked about how we were going to do this presentation, I said, I think we should focus on Southern Africa because of the following reasons. It's a region of contrasts. In actual fact, we're focusing on Southern Africa because that's where I'm from, and I know the data best. So let me be honest with you, that's why Southern Africa. But But nonetheless, it is a region of contrasts. And I think that if you were to take a look at the countries of the region, you will find some deeply fascinating things going on there. We've got South Africa, a wealthy, diverse, populous country. We've got Mozambique, which is impoverished. We've got a failing state in Zimbabwe. So we've got a microcosm of what's going on around the world. And for me, one of the great mysteries of this epidemic is the fact that we don't operate regionally. We operate in our own sectors. We operate in our own countries. SADC is a complete disaster when it comes to responding to the epidemic, and that's a tragedy for us because it is a regional epidemic. It's a region of great contrast in terms of wealth, as I already indicated. If you look at the GDP figures, you've got South Africa there with over $10,000 per person per annum in purchasing power parity. You've got Mozambique right down at the other end with less than $500 per person. It's a region of inequality, huge inequality. And it's interesting that impoverished Mozambique shows up best on the Gini coefficient. I put Belgium there because I can't think of anything else that Belgium's got going for it at this point, so I thought I'd show that figure as a matter of interest. We've got huge inequalities, and I would speculate that that's one of the things that's driving this epidemic, and I'll turn to that as we go through the presentation. It's a region with huge problems with HIV, as we see from the HIV prevalence, which I'll come back to, with differences in life expectancy. The difference between, but now this problem with this slide, of course, is this is life expectancy with HIV/AIDS taken into account. So what does the history look like? Well, this is when someone like myself, who started working in this field back in 1987, really begins to wonder whether it's possible to learn from history. And I would have to speculate that perhaps it's not possible. And I think that if we look at the history of the epidemic in the region, we find something which is quite troubling. 1983, we saw the first cases of this epidemic, primarily located in the gay male population in South Africa. We didn't know what to do. We did the blood safety. In fact, Zimbabwe was almost the second country, the second country in the world to do blood safety. We did the short-term plan. Of course, we in South Africa didn't have the benefit or disbenefit of UNAIDS and the other members of the alphabet soup. Well, in fact, UNAIDS wasn't in existence then. It was the GPA. But they came in to these countries across Southern Africa with their SDPs, which stood for short-term plans, with their MTPs, medium-term plans, put them in place, and it had no effect. In the 1990s, the epidemic really took off. And that's also the time when we began to collect data. We began to find that HIV prevalence was rising rapidly. The evidence seems to suggest that we're now entering a period of stabilization. Certainly incidence levels have probably peaked. But 2000 to 2010 is the time when we're really going to see the impact of this epidemic. And I don't know why I put 2010 there, because actually it leads us to at least 2020 and perhaps beyond. Now, let me show you a slide which for me is deeply shocking. I said that this epidemic only started in the 1990s in South Africa, and this is clear evidence of that fact. This is a table which shows you HIV prevalence by year, by age, in a district of KwaZulu-Natal called Labisa. And what you see there is in 1992, HIV prevalence in the 20 to 24 age group was just 6.9%. And in the 35 to 39 age group, there was no HIV located at all. Look at what happens year on year until in 2001. We have the unbelievable HIV prevalence rate of 50.8% among the 20 to 24-year-old cohort. And look what happened to those 20 and 24-year-olds over time. Look how HIV prevalence steadily rose. Of course, by the time they get to this age, many of them have died. So if we were to look at the true prevalence in this population, I would guess it would probably be in the order of 50 to 60%. This is a new epidemic. It's an epidemic which only began at the moment when change was going on in South Africa and thus across the region. If you look at 1990, Our first sero survey was done in that year. It found less than 0.5% prevalence among antenatal clinic attenders. If you look today, then prevalence among our antenatal clinic attenders is estimated at 29.5%. 30%, one in three women who are childbearing are carrying this virus. And I think looking back at this epidemic curve, one has to say, why did it happen? Did it have to happen? And maybe the answer is there wasn't much we could do about it. I don't know. But certainly we failed because we didn't do what needed to be done. Now, of course, South Africa has a particularly unique history. South Africa was going through the turmoil of the ending of apartheid, of the election of the new government, of the close to civil war that we had in 1993-1994. So is South Africa unique? Sadly, as you can see from this graph, no, not at all. Swaziland, where I come from, currently has an HIV prevalence of 42.5% among their antenatal clinic attenders. Botswana, it's ticking over at about 38%. Namibia is interesting. It seems to have peaked, and we'll watch with interest what happens over the next few years. So I think if we look at the history of this epidemic in terms of HIV, what we find is a glaring indictment of our responses, a glaring indictment of our failure of health, of development, of many other things, because this didn't need to happen, and yet it has. So let's talk a bit about where we are today. I find this incredibly depressing, so I'm going to share it with you. After all, they say a burden shared is a burden halved. I don't think we're in a particularly good place today. I think we're actually in quite a catastrophic place today. Although, and we will see some data at UNGAS, there are suggestions that we might globally be nearing the peak. There was a very interesting article in The Lancet which suggested that the global incidence may have peaked. That is not a cause for comfort. And the reason is because of the other bullet points. First of all, the numbers of people who are sick and dying is increasing. If I was to give this lecture 5 years ago, I would be talking about something in the abstract. But this epidemic is touching my workforce, my colleagues, and my friends. This is no longer an abstract issue for me. And the numbers of sick and dying will continue to increase. Why? Because we don't have a cure. Why? Because treatment is slow. Treatment could be rolled out in South Africa, but I would argue that the chances of making treatment available in quantities that are meaningful in countries like Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Swaziland are pretty minimal. Why? Because we're not even getting to grips on the prevention issues today. And until we do, then treatment, frankly, is mopping the floor while the tap is running. Why? Because the impacts may be being absorbed. We're not seeing the catastrophic state failure, except in the case of Zimbabwe, and to what extent AIDS might be responsible for that, I don't know. We're not seeing the catastrophic feral orphans roaming the streets of Johannesburg or Harare or Windhoek. We're not seeing it. But I can tell you that out there in the rural areas and in the slums around our cities, people are absorbing the impact, and it's at a cost. It's a cost to the grandmothers, a cost to the extended families. There may be a tipping point. I don't know what it is. I hope we don't have to find out, though. So what are we looking at today? Well, this is what we're looking at. We're looking at HIV prevalence, which is predominantly located among young women. Stephen Lewis goes on about gender issues, and I totally agree with him. This is a disease where the burden is being borne, the infections are being borne by women, where you're finding HIV in all age groups among the older men. This is antenatal prevalence in our national survey. So this isn't pregnant women. These aren't women who are sexually active. Well, they are because they're HIV infected. They're not pre-selected in the sense that they're attending antenatal clinics. These are the broad population. And what we find is in the 25 to 29 age group, HIV prevalence is pushing 35%. And what we're finding when we look at our data is that prevention is not working yet. Because if it were working, we'd expect to see a decrease in this age group here, in the young women. But what you find is a steady stability there. And what is even more troubling is the slight increases in older age groups, which means these people may be delaying sexual intercourse, but when they start having partners, they're becoming infected. That's the reality that we face across Southern Africa at the moment. So, as I said, I find this all rather depressing, but I don't think that it necessarily need be entirely depressing. Because I think that what I'm painting is a rather bleak picture. But what I now want to do is just put in front of you that there are three challenges that we face. And if we can tackle these three challenges, then I believe we can make a difference to the way this epidemic is rolling out. And the first challenge is the challenge of prevention. The second is the challenge of treatment and care. And the third one is the challenge of impact mitigation. And it's knowing how to live with the long-term consequences of this epidemic. Now, what I'm going to do is show you three slides which illustrate these three challenges. This first slide is a very one which any of you who have been to any of the lectures I've given before will have seen. Basically, this is an HIV curve. And I hope we're near the peak. I really do hope we're near the peak. But the point about this is that there are always new cohorts of people becoming sexually active. There are people in the cohorts who are sexually active who are not infected. And our challenge is to make sure that the next generation is not infected. Our challenge is to look at this epidemic and ensure that somehow, some way, we make sure that the next generations are not infected. If you want to look at a website, there's quite an interesting one. I don't think it's terribly scientific, but there's the Durex Global Sex Survey, www.durex.com. Very interesting, worth looking at. They've been doing it year on year, and even if people lie, perhaps they're lying consistently. But what this is showing us is that people believe that children need to be educated younger by far than we do educate them anywhere in the world. According to the survey, the earliest that anybody is getting sex education is around 11 and a half. According to what people say, and in the UK it's 12 and a half, according to what people say, we have to reach children earlier. And I think it's time to stop this namby-pamby pussyfooting around sex education and recognize that we have to do it and we have to do it sooner. Prevention is critical. As long as we don't have prevention, everything else we do is mopping the floor while the tap is running. The second area of concern is around AIDS cases. Now, the reality is, if you have HIV infections, you're going to have AIDS cases. They're going to follow along behind. We're seeing this in South Africa. We're seeing this very, very clearly in the groups I work with, in the groups I interact with in Durban. And that gives us our second challenge, because our second challenge is the challenge of care and treatment. It's a challenge of providing antiretroviral therapy where appropriate. It's a challenge of helping people to live positively. It's a challenge of dealing with the many illnesses that people will face that we can deal with through appropriate medication. It's a challenge of providing those drugs, and it's a challenge of when they fail, and they will fail, of providing people with the palliative care that they then need to see them through to the ends of their lives. That's the second challenge which I'd like to pose. The third challenge is the one where we least manage, and I think this is something which Tony will pick up in his presentation, which is the challenge of dealing with the impact. The reality is that this epidemic is leaving behind a legacy which we are not equipped to deal with, a legacy among our populations that we have never had to deal with before. And I do not believe that we have yet started thinking about what impact this epidemic will have on our populations. So what then are the prospects? I think there are some certainties. There's a certainty that we will face increased morbidity, and there's a certainty that we will face increased mortality. I believe that in Southern Africa we face a number of possible scenarios, but I think broadly there are two. The first one is that we don't get to grips with this epidemic, that we go on thinking that taking a shower is the way to protect yourself after sex, that we go on thinking that we can treat women as objects, that we go on thinking that perhaps there are people in our populations that don't matter. If that is the case, and treatment is slow, as it will be, then our future is somewhat bleak. But there are things happening. And I believe we can also paint a hopeful future. I believe we could paint a future which has optimism, but what it needs is leadership. What it needs is sustained international support. We, as part of the Commission on HIV/AIDS and Governance, have been looking at flows of assistance to development. And it's amazing when you look at what health ministries are getting. The graph shows it goes up, and then it goes right down, and then it goes up again. And we are being asked by the developed nations of this world to roll out treatment when we don't know if we're going to have enough money to pay the doctors next year. We are being asked to put in sustained programs when we don't know when the money will arrive, or indeed if it will, when we don't know what caveats there are. I was talking to a colleague from a war-torn part of the world where they have received money from the Global Fund in October. They have yet to see a cent. And you can't bank a promise. You can't buy a mortgage with a promise. Next time any of you thinks you can, try putting it to your bank manager. Yes, the money will come. So I think we need that leadership, we need that international support, and we need social mobilization. And this is the good news that I'll bring you, is that there is a mobilization happening out there in Africa. There is a mobilization happening in the townships of South Africa, in the villages of Swaziland. There is a mobilization going on. And the mobilization is being led by the most unusual people. Or perhaps it isn't that unusual. It's being led by the women, by the grandmothers, by the people who are fed up with seeing their children and grandchildren die. There is a mobilization happening, and maybe all we have to do is find the ways to support that. Maybe, I don't know. But let's be clear that whatever you have going wrong in your society, what AIDS does is it amplifies it. It makes it that much harder to do. Let me, in my last few slides, just return to some of the impacts, because I think I want to just make a few points in conclusion. First one is, it's going to take a long time. HIV prevalence in Uganda, peaking 1989-1990, orphans peaking 14 years later. Well, you know what that means? That means that if you go back to those Swaziland graphs, those South African graphs that I showed you, if HIV peaks this year in Swaziland or in South Africa, and there's no guarantee it will, but if it peaks this year, then we'll see a peak in the orphaning in 14, 15, 16 years' time. That's 2020. How many of you think 14, 15 years ahead? That's the sort of timescale we're looking at. It's a long wave event. The second thing is that there are things happening that we have no idea how to deal with. Falling life expectancy. What happens in a society where life expectancy goes from close to 64 to 36 in the matter of 10 years, 15 years? What happens in a society when people don't believe there's any point in investing in a mortgage or an education because they think they're going to die? What happens in a society when life expectancy is at levels not seen for centuries? And the answer is, we don't know. And I have to say that I think it is a searing indictment of the lack of engagement of political scientists that they haven't engaged around this. What happens to a society? What happens, I have to ask, when this generation of grandmothers dies? We don't know. And of course, the children. What happens to those children who do not have the parenting, who do not have the support, who do not have the love that they need? Those of us who are parents in this audience all know that it's a time-consuming thing. And we all feel guilty about the amount of time we don't spend with our children. Well, these kids, these orphan children, don't have anybody to spend time with them. They don't have it. What happens to a child who grows up without the love and the support? And again, I have to say it's a searing indictment of the academic community that we haven't engaged around this, that we haven't asked ourselves what happens to a generation where 25% are orphaned, because we don't know. And, of course, we go to UNGAS in a few weeks' time, don't we? We go to the UN and we battle over wordings of documents. And we lose sight of the big picture, which is that AIDS means that we are not going to meet the MDGs. But then maybe we don't care about the MDGs anymore. I don't know. But we'll bring forward the grand declarations of UNGAS, which we will have sweated over in the back rooms. And what will it mean? Because I have to tell you that in the villages of Africa, in the villages of Southern Africa, in the slums of Southern Africa, the people are dying. Maybe what we have to do is just what we can as individuals. And this is, I grew up in Swaziland, so I'm allowed to do this. This is a little project from Swaziland which says, okay, let's make a difference to a few kids. Let's make a difference to a few children. Let's ask the global community to help us with the orphans of Swaziland. Is that as much as we can do? Well, you know what? I'd rather you did that than nothing. I'd rather we did that than nothing. Because at least that way one is making a difference to some people's lives. So was AIDS inevitable? Well, I don't know. I suspect it probably was. You had this dreadful coincidence of apartheid. You had the type of colonialism with the British indirect rule, which said that basically people would be happy working in the urban areas and then going back to the rural areas where their wives and cattle were. You had the totally ineffectual rule of the Portuguese in Mozambique, Angola. There was this horrible coincidence. But it didn't need to be. Then, of course, we had the lack of leadership because of the other priorities. The ending of apartheid. The need to build reconciliation. The need to create economic growth. And I think perhaps for a Southern African, South African, this is the biggest, hardest thing that sticks in the throat, the lack of leadership. Not just in my country, where, as you all know, we religiously take showers, but beyond my country, in Swaziland, where the king religiously takes wives, or in Namibia, where gay marriage is being actively outlawed, never mind societies where you bring laws in to make it possible, there they're making laws to make it impossible. Or Zimbabwe, where a failing state means that AIDS isn't anywhere on the agenda. Was it inevitable? Well, maybe inequitable economic development meant that there was going to be a degree of inevitability about it, and I would refer to Cathy Campbell's book, Letting Them Die, which shows just why this might have been the case. I don't know about HIV and AIDS. I do know that this is a somewhat convoluted lecture and it's not very optimistic. But then it's very hard as you watch people dying to be optimistic. I do believe we can make a difference. I believe that it is possible to make a difference, and maybe it's in small ways. Maybe it's each of us individually asking what we can do and doing it. But I do know one thing. When we look back, this epidemic has marched on us with an inevitability that we could have seen. When we look forward, it's going to be with us for a long time to come. But you know what? It's my opinion. This is just a harbinger of things to come. And AIDS has shown how global public health has failed. AIDS is showing us what we need to do. And I jolly well think we better be ready, because there's more coming. And into that, I'll hand over to Tony, who is now more coming now. There we go.
Seamlessly. I switched on, yes.
Always switched on. By the way, I have to correct one error of fact. I don't want to, I know Gwyn is really upset. Gwyn is actually very young. He's even younger than me. Well, Alan finished by asking the question, was HIV/AIDS inevitable? And what I want to do in this lecture is to examine some of the things we might learn from the HIV/AIDS epidemic and to consider what we need to do in relation to infectious diseases more generally in the light of what we've learned from our really rather inadequate dealing with this epidemic. The structure of the lecture is as follows. I want, first of all, to talk about HIV/AIDS as a long-wave event in a little bit more detail. And then I want to talk about some of the lessons that I think we must learn. Then I want to look at taking those lessons forward into the future, when I shall leave HIV/AIDS behind and talk much more generally about the threat from a whole variety of diseases, infectious diseases. And finally, just not to leave it entirely up in the air, I will come up with some quite specific suggestions for what we need to do. So first of all, HIV/AIDS is a long-wave event. The last 30 years or so have really been odd in many ways, but we've lived with two long-wave events which have been in the background. One of them is global warming, which is a much longer-wave event and which a great deal of attention is focused on right now. And the other one, which is the short long-wave event, although it's a question of how short it's going to be, which is the HIV/AIDS epidemic. What do we mean by a long-wave event? Well, the first thing is they're very large-scale events where the effects emerge gradually over decades. The second thing is they're not the same as short-wave events, otherwise we wouldn't be making that distinction. I'm going to say more about that in a minute. Both of them have long-term effects, no doubt about that. Both short and long-term, long-wave events have long-term effects, but the type of events differ, and the distinction is very important. So the general characteristics of a long-wave event are, well, first of all, pretty obviously, we don't know when it starts. We're unlikely to have a day when something flags up in a newspaper and says, long-wave event starting today. Specifically, that's really important, because it's upon us before we're aware that it's happening, so we're having to deal with its effects before we've had any experience of it. Once it started, it's characterized by the fact that it's very difficult to slow it down, to throw it into reverse, and most unlikely to be stoppable. Thirdly, and the biggest challenge, I suppose, really for those charged with dealing with such events, and for those, as here, charged with thinking about such events, is that I think that long-wave events require a different kind of thinking to that which is familiar to us from short-wave events. Fourthly, it's difficult to halt and to slow because it's difficult to get public opinion, political opinion, organized sufficiently to mobilize resources and to take appropriate actions. And fifthly, a long-wave event falls outside the normal time horizon of politicians, business leaders, even those working for NGOs. Long-term for those people usually means about 5 years. Here, we're talking about 50 years, 100 years, 150 years. So these are very long-term things indeed. And we've seen all these things in relation to the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Let me just show you the difference between a short-wave event and a long-wave event. Cholera. Infectious disease. We know what causes it. The symptoms are very immediate in the individual. They're very immediate in the community where cholera strikes. We know that it's happening very soon after it begins. And we know how to respond. We know about standard public health measures. We know about vaccination. We know about the treatment of infected and sick people. Let me take you to a very remote part of the Indian Ocean, the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, hit very badly by the tsunami. But also, in about 2 or 3 years ago, hit very badly by an outbreak of cholera. So here is one, here are the Andaman and Nicobar Islands in the Bay of Bengal, and here is one pair of those islands. When cholera broke out there, it started in community here, early in October. And it really came to an end when it reached up to here and over to here by the end of October and by the early part of November. So that was about 6 weeks. And that's a typical shortwave disease event. And here it is represented in your typical epidemic disease curve. Few cases, geometric increase, levelling off. And here are those cases as recorded in that particular outbreak. Few cases, not quite as neat as the other curve, of course, but here's the reality. And then a rapid increase and then a dropping away. That's the shortwave disease event. HIV is a very different kind of event. First of all, there is a resonance between the nature of the pathogen and the kind of event that it creates. It's a lentivirus. It acts very slowly in the human body. It has a long life cycle in the human body. It's a retrovirus. It actually has difficulty replicating itself effectively, and therefore there's a lot of mutation goes on. And these result in particular long-wave characteristics. Here is a picture of the viral population in an individual as reflected in the quantity of virus in semen sample. And it shows how on infection, the viral load increases very dramatically and then the immune system fights back. And then there's an ongoing struggle, depending on the health of the particular individual, their circumstances, until in the end, without treatment, HIV infection turns into AIDS, and the viral load increases, and death ensues. Mean period without treatment from infection to death, 8 to 9 years. So remember that curve, the one I just showed you. I've teased it out here, because I'm going to come back to it and mention it later. Here's a diagram showing the reproductive cycle of the virus, and it shows how, because it's an RNA virus, remember that as well, because I'll come back to that, because it's an RNA virus, there are problems in the particular way that it reproduces, which produces mutations. The result at the macro level is a very long epidemic curve, which, as Alan has shown you, and I'm showing you now for the whole of Africa using some old data, lasts for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Because the important point Alan made was that each new generation fuels the epidemic anew as they become sexually active. So that's the situation of this long wave event. What lessons can we learn from that? First lesson is about knowing. How do we know that an epidemic is happening? What do you measure? With the case of HIV, it's a sexually transmitted disease. It was very difficult to begin to pick up the information. There's been a lot of debate about the quality of the information put out by UNAIDS. There have been debates about whether the seroprevalence level in country X is 20%, 15%, 18%, 30%. Actually, these are such huge figures, whether they're 15% or above, 10% or above, that I think that's a little bit of often an argument made for purposes which are not necessarily scientific. So there's a real problem of data with a long wave event, which actually then gives rise to a political policy resource allocation problem around risk. There's the risk of being wrong and letting it happen. There's the risk of being right, but too late. And there's the risk of being right and taking effective action, which is avoiding action, if you know what to do, and people saying, oh, well, what was all the fuss about? Nothing happened. So there are real risks, and I'm acutely aware, looking in the audience here at our colleagues from DFID, that they're the folk who actually carry that kind of risk the whole time, of making the wrong decision for the right reasons, or the right decision, not the right decision for the wrong reasons, but the right decision, and because it works, actually then is being told, well, why did you allocate these resources? Nothing happened. And it's very difficult to be able to show that you've got the right data and you're making the right decisions. And these are real problems for policy makers and for politicians, and I think that given the typically short-term time span with which people live, this compounds the problem of resource allocation and of response. And it's a problem not only for them, it's a problem for us all, and it's now a global problem. So the us for whom it is a problem is a very major global problem. And what I'm going to go on to argue is it's really important for us to be starting to think globally. Alan has mentioned global health systems. I'm going to talk about one aspect of global health systems, which is the need for effective infectious disease surveillance systems in our world, because we can't lock infectious disease epidemics away, whatever our immigration laws might be. So within data, the question of data, there's a real tension between advocacy and accuracy. If you advocate, you need to have impressive data. UNAIDS has done this consistently. And HIV is particularly hard to track for a whole range of reasons. So the temptation has always been to give the most spectacular figures. And to maintain the momentum of interest, advocacy takes a great deal of effort, particularly with a long wave event. And I think that is a real problem that we face with long wave events. How do you keep up the momentum of interest to ensure that resources are allocated when you're not sure quite what's happening, but it's happening around you, and the temptation is to elaborate and perhaps in some cases to exaggerate the situation because you're competing all the time with other more pressing shortwave events. So there's a real issue here about the nature of data and the use of data. The next lesson I draw is about the role of political correctness and efficiency and the condom. Sounds like the title of a rather bad film. Political correctness, efficiency and the condom. Right, here goes with the contentious bit. We do know what you do with disease outbreaks. The Cubans, I can see people's backs arching as I say this, the Cubans very effectively controlled their HIV epidemic by intervening at an early stage. In early epidemics, we know what you do. Contact tracing, even we may want to limit people's movements. Now, it's a very interesting story here about the role of the human rights discourse and the human rights approach, which took root in the whole response to HIV/AIDS and was deployed right across the world, in my view, in circumstances where it may well have been quite inappropriate. And that, I think, has to do with the specific history of HIV in the United States in the gay male community. People who were fighting for a political space and for recognition of their needs and whose recourse in that situation was to human rights discourse. I do not think it was necessarily the right approach in many other circumstances. And that's something we need to think about. Okay, got that off my chest. Second contentious thing, condoms. I think condoms are one of the most absurd responses to the HIV epidemic in many respects. They were a very good response for a gay male community. But what they actually did was to use, in the African situation, the already installed capacity of the reproductive health business, who were good at distributing condoms, and to distribute lots of condoms. Now, actually, many issues arise about the acceptability of condoms in particularly poor rural and poor urban circumstances. So a lot of money went into condom distribution, and very little money went into the development of female-controlled microbicides early on, which would actually have been, in my view, a much better strategy to have pursued 15 years ago, but which was not funded. Third thing was the one-size-fits... Oh, sorry about this following from condoms. Quite unintentional, I assure you. There was the one-size-fits-all There was the one-size-fits-all response. There are political pressures which say that overhead costs must be very small and outputs must be very small, very large. So therefore, what we want to do is to scale up. We find the magic bullet and then we scale it up. That's a very medical model, because that's what medics do. You find a technique which works in a small clinic, you then scale it up to production line surgery or treatment. It's a very economistic way of looking at things. It's about cost saving. It's about the biggest number of bangs for your buck. But actually, it's probably quite inappropriate in a situation where it's precisely scale-up, which is not something we understand, even if we understand what are the right interventions in terms of prevention or impact mitigation, when what we're dealing with is a great deal of diversity. Now, here's something people from DFID will like to hear. Political pressures on an agency such as DFID are always aimed at cutting down the expenditure on government. By cutting down expenditure on government, you cut people's time up into salami slices, so they do 1/18th of their time on this program, and 1/15th of their time on this program, and 1/36th of their time on this program, until in the end, the poor people have no idea of what it is that they're managing, because they haven't got time to look carefully enough. And that kind of effort to cut down the cost of implementation by having scale up was a totally inappropriate response to an extremely diverse epidemic. One size didn't fit all. The short-term programs, the medium-term programs, which Alan referred to, were quite inappropriate, and we needed a different approach, and we need to learn that we need a different approach, because both prevention and mitigation, perhaps not so much with treatment, but I remain to be convinced about that, need to recognize the diversity of response which can engage with the heterogeneity of local conditions. It's absolutely necessary. So it may be that we have to think about spending more money on implementation. Problem number three, the third thing we need to learn. We failed to act in two very specific areas of impact mitigation. I first started doing research on the rural impact of AIDS in 1986. And actually, neither FAO, nor DFID, nor any agency has any idea of what you do to mitigate the effects of HIV on rural societies. The evidence now is very large that it has quite serious effects on rural societies. How could it not? The common response is to say, well, okay, this kills people, so you need labour-economising technologies. Okay, show me an appropriate labour-economising technology. They don't exist, not for these circumstances, where the period of adoption required to get these things in place is probably as long as, or longer than, that viral curve which leads from initial infection to death, which I showed you earlier. So there's a problem with the length of the innovation curve for the technology in relation to the epidemic process. There's a problem with whether or not the existing labour-saving technologies are appropriate for situations where communities and households are under enormous stress because of illness and death. People die before they can adopt whatever technology may be being marketed to them, and the next generation is also confronted with a worse situation. So we don't understand that, and that problem was identified as early as 1986, long-wave event. Alan's mentioned the orphans. Understanding how you respond to a situation with these levels of orphaning is something we do not have. We don't have that understanding. The Swazi situation, in a decade, 15% of the total population of Swaziland will be orphans. Now, Swaziland's a particularly interesting example because it's such a small country. What do you do in a tiny country of less than 1 million people when 15% of the population are orphans? And then there's a related problem, which is the danger of blind linkages of HIV/AIDS to security agendas. I put security in inverted commas. Here's a story. South Africa is sitting on an AIDS orphan time bomb that could unleash a tidal wave of crime and civil unrest. Up to 3 million children will be orphaned within the next 10 years. The burgeoning orphan population, which will grow up under extreme levels of poverty, will be sorely tempted, or even obliged for its physical survival, to turn to crime, drugs, gangs, and sex trade. God, lock your windows, folks. Just lock your windows. And the state will fail, of course. Well, this is the fourth problem. There are numerous discourses, as we social scientists and people at places like LSE like to say. There are numerous discourses at work. Very recently, at a meeting which Alan and I were at, a very senior US security analyst said, the US public will not attend or act unless there is a threat. Ah, so AIDS becomes securitized. It's in all kinds of people's interests for AIDS to be securitized. Link orphans, fragile states, security. And where did it first appear? It first appeared in consultations held by the US National Intelligence Council, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but the problem is, people take up the story and there's no evidence. Now, it's a long-wave event. Maybe we need to look for the evidence. Maybe there isn't any evidence. Gwyn Prince and I were asked last year to look at the issue of the relationship between HIV/AIDS and the military. We produced a report. There's a picture of the front cover. What we found was that some very well-established truths which pass around the policy community internationally about the relationship between HIV/AIDS and the military are actually not true. Not true in any devious sense, not true only in the sense that there's no evidence for most of them. Same with HIV/AIDS and orphans and security, discourses at work. These are really major problems which actually run right through the whole experience of HIV/AIDS as a long-wave event, and we need to pay attention to them. Now, how can we take these lessons forward? Those of you who came to Laurie Garrett's lecture last year will remember this slide and the next one. Very interesting slide. Here is the time it takes to travel around the world in 1850, around a year. Here is the time it takes to travel around the world in 2000, a couple of days, going fairly steadily. Here is the world population. Next time you pass through an airport where you're meeting all kinds of strange people, just fleetingly, when you're sharing breath with them, as you are in this lecture theatre, hold your breath, folks, because there's a huge concentration of diverse people exhaling and inhaling into your own nostrils a range of horrible pathogens, nasty, infectious little creatures, which will make you sick. Here, again, is Laurie Garrett's slide. Looking at the number of very large cities which will be in existence in 2015. Look at the size of these cities. 26 million. Very, very large places. Huge concentrations of people. Don't go there. Could be very nasty. So the point of both those slides is the probability of moving infectious disease pathogens around the world has increased. The density of population has increased. We're in a dangerous world. What can we learn from the HIV/AIDS epidemic about this situation? We panic when we come to SARS. We get very worried about avian flu. Well, let's look at the situation. Just to make you really feel secure as you walk out into the street after this lecture, I'd like you to know that there are 1,407 human pathogens which are currently recognised. 1,400 is quite a lot, really. Some of them have subsets. So there's a lot of poisonous things about. Of these, 13%, 177, are regarded as emerging or re-emerging. New, in some sense. And now, more worryingly, of this subset, 38 were first recognised in the last 25 years. Now that reflects, of course, better detection. On average, three new species of pathogen are recognised every 2 years. And some of them we hear about, some of them stay in remote places and we don't hear anything about. What they're characterised by are their great diversity. They fall across the whole range of pathogens. they're biologically very diverse. They have different epidemic shapes, and they fall all over the world. What are these pathogens? Well, they fall into the following categories: microparasites, of which there are viruses, bacteria, fungi, protozoa, athlete's foot is such a thing. If you ever suffer from athlete's foot, it's one of those fungi which hangs around for weeks and weeks. Here's some pictures of them. They're quite pretty when you put them on slides. Then there's the bigger things. Helminths, nasty worms. Here's a nasty worm. Tapeworms, but also much smaller things. And then there are things like ticks and lice, but we don't deal with those. This is derived from work done by Mark Woolhouse and his team at the University of Edinburgh under the auspices of the Department of Trade and Industry's Foresight Project. Well, what do these emerging and re-emerging pathogens do? What are their characteristics? Well, most of them are viruses, and they're disproportionately RNA viruses. Now, these are the viruses of which HIV is an example. And they have difficulties reproducing because of this very particular characteristic. They have mutation abilities which are a little bit larger than in other viruses. They're disproportionately zoonotic, which means they come from other hosts, other animal hosts, non-human vertebrates. And as you'll see, many of them cattle, undulates. Here we are. Undulates are the most common, the largest source of these kinds of zoonotic infections. And they also tend to be pathogens which have a broad range of potential hosts. So if we look at this graph, we see that since 1980, there's been a steady rise in the number of newly recognized emerging human pathogen species, reflecting not that there's been some enormous outbreak of new pathogen species, but that we're much better at picking them up. And if you look at them in terms of what hosts they are most likely to be associated with, the red things here are the newly emerging pathogens. We find most of them in ungulates, in rodents, in carnivores, and in other non-mammalian species, lizards and things, I guess, and then some in primates. But it's mainly cattle type of things, things with horns and udders. The purpose of this rather complex slide is to show you that of the zoonotic, of all the emerging, there are 177 emerging pathogens, that's about 9% of the total numbers of nasties, of which 130 are emerging zoonotic pathogens. And that's the important point. These are pathogens which come to us from other animals. And how are these things passed on? Through food, through direct contact, the fecal-oral route, wash your hands, as I keep telling my 10-year-old, waterborne diseases, vector-borne diseases, and so on. But mostly, actually, food-borne and direct contact and fecal-oral route. Now, having that basic information, what would you do? I use Africa here as an example just because I happen to work mainly in Africa. It's not a peculiarly African situation, except that Africa is a very poor and disrupted continent. What we did, I worked on this with a member of LSE here, Paolo Anciens, who made these maps for me. We looked at the main population densities across Africa, highly dense and least dense, and we looked at the main movements of people on the African continent in terms of international migration, refugee movements, regional migration, and normal rural to urban migration. And what you see is there's a great confluence of people down here into South Africa, for very obvious reasons, and also here onto the West African coast. And when we move on and we look at another map here, which is perhaps not quite as easy to understand, we try to look at the way in which population concentrations were associated with the potential for zoonotic transfers. So what we were most interested in was what kinds of things are happening in these large and growing urban centres across Africa in terms of the distribution between proportion of the population undernourished, living in very poor housing conditions, no water connection, no sewage connection, under five mortality, gross poverty, use of solid fuel. And we have just drawn out of that map some examples of what we found in terms of, for example, Kinshasa and Lubumbashi. Here you find that no sewage connection and undernourishment, use of solid fuel. What's most interesting on these is that we do not have information about just the thing we really need to know about, which is urban agriculture, because that's the cattle keeping in towns. I was meeting quite recently a Kenyan colleague in Kenya who described how in his rather posh suburb of Nairobi, early in the morning, what you hear most of all is the sound of cows mooing. Why? Because his wife and other wives around that area are keeping cattle as a small industry. It's a way of earning some money. It brings fresh milk into town. Now that is a very high zoonotic risk situation. We don't know very much about it. What we need to do is actually to be able to take a map like this and to be able to identify the kinds of situations where those potential transfers are most likely to be happening. We don't know very much at all about the socioeconomics of infectious disease transmission. In relation to HIV/AIDS, there's a great deal spoken about the relationship between disease transmission and poverty, disease transmission and gender inequality. Yes, those are undoubtedly factors in transmission. But what we really need to have is a socioeconomic understanding of transmission gradients within societies in relation to infectious diseases. And we do not have a way forward on that yet. I think it's a really important area of research. I think it's not a popular area of research. I think that, above all, in a place like LSE, we should be researching the socioeconomics of infectious disease transmission and infectious disease effects. We don't understand the links. We make assumptions which say that we do. I don't think we do. We know quite a lot about socioeconomic inequality and chronic diseases, but we don't know very much about what happens with infectious diseases. And those maps I've just shown you were some way to just begin to get a grip on that. Now here's another way to get a grip on it and to look at the bigger picture, because I think this is the very big lesson we need to learn from the HIV/AIDS epidemic. This matrix shows you a set, not exhaustive, of all the ways in which we humans and our pathogenic neighbours interact. The ways in which pathogens are transmitted from them to us and actually, in some cases, from us to them. And here are all the different classes of pathogens. Each one of these could be expanded into dozens of discrete disease types, but I've kept them very small for reasons of presentation. So here we have foodborne diseases which are viruses, foodborne diseases which are bacteria, fungi, and so on. Protozoa, if you ever had one of those nasty tummy bugs that you get when you go to places you're not used to travelling in, it was probably a little protozoa, a little animal, or it might even have been a little wormy helminth. Now, behind this matrix, there lies an evolutionary process. These bugs do not stay still. They actually evolve in response to pressures to which they are subjected. They can jump from being in one category of transmission to another category of transmission. So there's an evolutionary process going on underneath this. Now, what happens if you have a virus which is currently sexually transmitted, but under pressure of treatment, it alters its transmission route to aerosol, to sneezing? Now, there's a nasty thought for you. What happens if you have a vertically transmitted virus from mother to child, which then is picked up by a vector? Now, these are not things that are happening to our knowledge. They are things that we know have happened, and we know they are things that could happen. What happens if you have a foodborne bacterium which becomes waterborne? Perhaps quite easy to understand how that would happen. Or a vector-borne protozoa which can become waterborne. We need to be looking at the whole issue of infectious diseases in the light of this kind of perception. Because only in that way can we begin to pick up the next long-wave disease event. So here's a hard agenda for the future. Things we need to do. None of them very spectacular. All of them pretty difficult. First of all, we have to recognise that globalisation increases risk. And the medieval response to lepers of casting them outside from the city walls is no longer practical. Immigration controls are in some ways one of the most counterproductive things because it pushes the disease underground. So there's a whole issue there about the way in which we relate our legislation about really quite politically charged issues in relation to infectious diseases. We need to recognise that the emergence of global health threats is a feature of changing social, political, economic, blah, 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 ecological conditions. But most importantly, here we need to recognise that research on global health threats has to be interdisciplinary. And I don't mean interdisciplinary in the sense only of, oh my God, an economist might talk to an anthropologist, although that's fairly unlikely as far as I can see. But actually we need to increase our understanding so that microbiologists talk to anthropologists, who talk to clinicians, who then talk to economists. That kind of interaction is extremely rare, and I think it's really important that we begin to develop that kind of capacity. In this area of London, the capacity is there, the bringing of it together is not. We need to build a global capacity for the surveillance of infectious diseases. Some of that is beginning to be developed, but it's surprisingly slow and very difficult to do. Great deal of international and interprofessional rivalry, even within identified fields of activity. At the national level, we need to build the capacity for a national infectious disease observatory, which is interdisciplinary in the sense that I've just outlined for you, which can actually look at the potential appearance of long-term threats and consider both the biological and the economic and social implications of such events, so that we do have the information when we need it. But of course there's one of those resources which, if it works, people will say, oh, why have we got it? Because we haven't had anything happen that was nasty. And the big challenges are to build an international architecture which can handle these kinds of threats and these kinds of surveillance processes. That's really the very big lesson from the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And it's the big lesson which Alan pointed to in his talk. We need to be looking at global systems of public health. What I have been talking to you about is one small aspect of such a system which can deal with long-term events of an infectious disease nature. We need to be able to integrate the activities of non-state actors, new public-private partnerships and global research networks, governments. We have to be able to do these things. Extremely difficult, but wouldn't it be nice if a Centre for Global Governance, if such a thing existed in any institution, oh God, there's one here, or degrees in international relations, actually dealt with those issues in relation to the long-term threats we face from infectious disease. Those are the kinds of lessons that we should learn from the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Thank you.
Thank you both very much indeed, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. So those of you who've got to go now, please do. And for the rest, we can... Right, so we've got 20 minutes or so for questions. So if you'd like to indicate, and then there are people with microphones who will come to you. If you'd like to start. Of course, it makes it much easier if nobody's got any questions. So.
There was a similar epidemic in the 16th century from syphilis. Is there any data that relates to this problem that we could discover?
I think that there's a remarkable book just been published by Charles C. Mann, in which he looks at the decimation. Well, it's not decimation, because decimation is 1 in 10. But the complete depopulation of the American indigenous populations. It's called Ancient Americans. It's published by Granta. And I think there are things we can learn, but I don't know how you actually get to grips with learning those things. So I let Tony comment about syphilis, but I think that there are lessons that we can learn. But what I'm afraid we don't do is the historians don't talk to the public health people. So that's the answer.
I won't expand on that. No, I agree. That's probably that is the situation. We have regular information about the Black Death. We know quite a lot about syphilis, but actually people don't draw the lessons. They get pulled back into the disciplines, and that's what I'm really crying for. Is we need to pull out that kind of information so that question doesn't have to be asked.
Lady Craig.
I have a student here who's from Southern Africa, from Zambia, who said that she has a lot of friends who are in their early 20s or so, and late teens, who know perfectly well how the disease is transmitted, could try to use condoms and things, but have deliberately chosen a kind of philosophy of life about, you know, live fast, die fast, you know. Live hard, have fun, and so AIDS gets you, you know, life is short. There's a kind of a philosophy developing in Southern Africa about how it's okay to live a short life as long as you live it to the full, and which suggests that education alone is not going to be the only answer. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, my response to that is, I show my age, is to think of the beat poets of the 1950s, who also, in many cases, lived their life hard and not very long. Now, you have to ask yourself, what kind of existential vision do people have which leads them to that kind of behaviour? In the case of the beat poets, I can hypothesise about many, many things. In the case of people in very poor countries, I think I would hypothesise around the issue of hope. I think one of the most important issues which is unexamined in any rigorous way in relation to the HIV/AIDS epidemic is what lack of hope or absence of hope creates the conditions where people make those individual decisions. What absence of hope exists because it's posited on a very, very short-term expectation of what you can do in this world, over what kind of future you have any control. And I think it's that hopelessness which in many ways it reflects poverty, but I think it's something rather different from the mere situation of poverty. So for me the issue comes down to one of hope, which sounds like a really soft kind of social science idea. I think it's an idea which, apart from some early work of Lionel Tiger, has yet to be examined in the social sciences.
Yeah, I think there are two things I would add to that. And the other thing is that we're seeing a collapse in cultures. And I think we're seeing that across Southern Africa. And again, this probably shows a certain degree of ageism. But I think that, you know, when you look at how cultures are collapsing and how there is no longer the framework in which you can operate, I think that's part of the problem, which is a terrible thing to say because I don't know what the answer is. And then the other issue is when I grew up in Swaziland, there was no such thing as television. I'm not saying television is the root of all these evils, but Tony showed a film here by Surya Samora, in which which he was talking to people in a bar in Zambia, and I think that was extraordinarily telling. But you know, if you're living in a slum in outside of Johannesburg, or you're living in a rural village, and your vision of the world is so beyond the beliefs that you can attain it, because it's what you're seeing on the television or on the DVDs, I think we've lost hope that way as well. And I think that there are some really
big issues here. I don't have the answer to that.
I'm Michael Borowitz. I'm from the Department for International Development. We have many other colleagues here. I'm from the Global Policy Division. We have the Africa Policy Division. We have the AIDS team. So, I mean, first let me respond to agenda items, you know, of recommendations. I have to say that on the issue of surveillance, that issue is being taken forward in the international architecture. And the new international health regulations actually creates new surveillance capacity, both within WHO through a network of different, both non-state actors also. And actually, it's the first time that reporting from non-state actors is actually part of the surveillance system. So this actually takes into account real changes in globalization and not just working through states. And if you have any other sort of practical recommendations, we would be very open to them. But let me just say from where I sit, I mean, I find this these talks a bit odd because I get a very Hobbesian vision of the world where life is nasty, short, and brutish. And yet from there's an alternative narrative, which is really sort of the Gatesian vision of investing in new technologies. And we have huge investments now going into an AIDS vaccine. Microbicides are coming out. We've had a huge increase in funding for HIV/AIDS. There was the creation of the Global Fund, the creation of PEPFAR, the 3x5 initiative. And so from an international perspective, we see the opposite, really. You know, we see Bono talking about AIDS. We see social global social mobilization and, you know, red cards for people to give money. So I'm not necessarily saying that that's reflected in progress on the ground. And that's actually a slightly different story. But I would say that from where we sit, there's huge activity on AIDS to the point where many other people say, well, what about other diseases? What about women dying in childbirth? What about children who are dying of diarrhea and respiratory infections? That all of the money coming into our countries, this is what ministers of health are telling us, is just for AIDS, and we can't actually use it to fund our health systems, and that now we're expected to put all these people on treatment, but we have failing health systems, and we can't really put people on treatment. And how are we supposed to do that? And so the stories that I hear are quite different, really, you know, at the global level. And, I mean, we are talking about billions of dollars of, you know, of funding that have now gone into AIDS, whereas 10 years ago, there was very little funding. So the question now is really how to convert that type of global social mobilization and those resources into effects on the ground. But I just don't see it really in such a Hobbesian framework. And it seems to me an awfully pessimistic view of the world.
I'll give this to Alan, but I can't restrain just making an observation, which is that it is possible for the engine to be racing, but if the clutch isn't working properly, then it doesn't go into the gearbox. Or perhaps even worse, that it does, but then the steering wheel is not going in the right direction, which is partly Tony's point, but Alan will no doubt want to speak for that.
I think there's a danger that you're listening to what your ministers are telling you, or maybe you're writing what your ministers are telling you. Because where I sit on the ground, it is a very Hobbesian view of the world. I mean, if we take, for example, PEPFAR, $15 billion, let's not deny the importance of that money, because it is important. What percentage is going to the Beltway Bandits, to John Snow International, to Family Health International, to AED? What percentage is going to the drug companies? What is actually getting onto the ground in African countries? And the answer is, where I'm sitting, very little. I sat with colleagues last 2 weeks ago, and we talked about money going to Swaziland, or money not going to Swaziland, because actually Swaziland is running out of money to pay its staff at the end of this month, because someone won't get off their arse in one of the capitals of this world and sign the bits of paper that will make the money flow. And what is also happening is that across the world, we're building up capacity to implement projects. We're recruiting from the failing health systems in order to plan implementation, which won't happen because the health systems are failing. Now, maybe my view is particularly jaundiced, and having a vice president who thinks the answer is taking showers does intend to jaundice one. But frankly, Michael, at this moment, I don't believe it because I don't see it happening.
I just add one thing to that, Michael, because I don't, in fact, disagree with a great deal of what you said. But I do disagree with one fundamental assumption that you make, which is that we actually know what we should be doing. We don't have a complete ignorance, but it's pretty damn near total, actually, on a lot of the issues which we've raised.
Right. as always happens on these occasions, you know, there are half a dozen people who want to speak. So make your points, please. Try and make them as succinctly as you can. It's this gentleman first.
Thank you. Good evening, and thank you for the lectures. This question is for Alan Moore. As we live in an age of sex panic, attack, and paranoia, could you elaborate on how we could educate children about sexuality transmitted diseases at an earlier age than we do now? Thank you.
Well, you know, one of the things about working in this field is that you think you have the answers, and I must confess that one of the things that I used to say when I gave lectures 10, 11 years ago was, we've got to educate our children, we've got to talk to our children. When my daughter turned 7, I tried talking to her. I was consumed with embarrassment. Now I can consume her with embarrassment, but then I couldn't do it. So I actually don't have the answers, and I think that this is one of the areas where we do need professionals. But what we need to do is to say we don't mind people talking to our children. And maybe that's the... And what our education authorities need to understand is that parents don't mind if this happens. That's the only answer I have. I'm sorry, one of the realities of this new book, which you're all going to buy in a few minutes, of course, is that we don't claim we have the answers, but we certainly put the questions quite well.
Fine, thanks very much. Yes. Oh, sorry, this gentleman next.
Hi. My name is Bill. I'm interested in the performance of Blue Sky Thinking right at the end.
Yeah.
In terms of, I mean, we always touched on evolution in biology, evolution in medicine.
Can you hold up the mic?
Where you were saying that, if I do it.
Why is it doing that?
There's another one here. Why don't you use this one here?
No, there's a good one there. We can hear it.
They'll give you the other one. Okay.
The comments at the end about the blue sky thinking and the long wave events. If you say that if we keep treating and we can't really start preventing infection, we'll actually drive it sideways into another route of transmission, be it foodborne or respiratory routes, then aren't the obvious implications of that that you shouldn't be trying to prevent infection? What you should be trying to do is prevent disease.
Sorry, hang on. No, just pointing so you get the microphone next. Did you want to speak on the phone?
No.
Okay. The next one's down here and then it's you.
Thank you very much. My name is Jeremy Hunt. I'm MP on the International Development Select Committee. And I'm afraid I missed Alan's talk because we had a vote at 7 o'clock, but I did hear Tony. I'd like to share my question actually with Robin Gorner, who's responsible for AIDS policy at DFID. But my question, and I think you touched on the UN special session on HIV/AIDS, it's happening next week. The 3x5 initiative ended up getting only 1.3 million onto antiretrovirals instead of the 5 million that it was intending to do so. And what I would just like to ask you is, what would you like to see happen next week to make sure that we don't have a similar lack of success with the All by 10 initiative to get everyone who needs them onto antiretrovirals by 2010?
I had to let him go first, because otherwise he'll ask a parliamentary question that I'll have to answer. The question I had was, Alan, you said about short and medium-term plans having failed, and I think you showed us some pretty compelling evidence of how the global community has failed to respond. We're talking a lot as we look towards ONGAS around planning, about country-led planning, and I wanted to ask you what lessons you drew and why those plans failed and what plans would succeed.
Okay. I have to be honest, I don't expect a lot out of ONGAS. We have had the Abuja Declaration, which has lamentably failed, where African governments were supposed to commit 15% of their budgets to health, and that hasn't worked. What would be nice is honesty. Just saying, you know, we haven't done terribly well. instead of rah, 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 we're going to do even better because we'll have new goals. And actually, UNGAS doesn't batter the bread and get the drugs out to people. So it's important, but not for me. And they didn't invite me either. No. It's important, but it's a political posturing, and I think more important is going to be some of the things that will come out of the Toronto conference, which will happen in August, because there will be new science, there will be an opportunity for people to gather and to make a statement which is important, given that you have it happening just a few hundred miles away from the United States. So I think that's an important meeting. What would make a difference, Robin's question? What would drive things at the state? Well, I think there are two points here. I think, first of all, the state isn't hegemonic. There's a diversity in the states. In my country, we're doing great things at provincial level, we're doing great things at community level. And I think and it's not a message you want to hear, is there is no easy answer. You have to do it at the very individual community level. We all know, those of us who are parents, that every child is different. And when you deal with your children, you have to deal with them differently. In exactly the same way, I think we have to deal with the epidemic in different ways in different societies.
I think that the point that I made, not in order to say if it really works very hard, but the point I made about the view that government is expensive and therefore must be kept as small as possible is precisely the point. You don't know in DFID what went wrong with those particular things. Why not? That's not an aggressive question. I'm saying, why don't you know? Because nobody has got the resources to find out, the time or the money. Secondly, we will go on expecting DFID to do more and more for less and less money. There's that nobody ever answers their emails until 5 days later. Well, you know, you're an exception. Because they're too busy running around trying to attend all kinds of meetings, at which, like UNGAS, there will be an awful lot of speech, but as Alan said, very little honesty and very little... Alan and I recently were involved in a consultation with a number of people who remain anonymous who might well be expected to know about HIV issues and what we do. Quite surprising how people are actually ready to admit that they don't really know. And the reason that we don't know is that we try to take ready-made solutions off the shelf, like the condom issue, like the medium-term plan, which were drawn up in the middle of Geneva into all kinds of places. And we haven't taken the time or the trouble to deal with the specificities of a long-wave event. That's the message. You can't do it on the cheap. This is expensive. But the future cannot be discounted so heavily that it's worth nothing. And that's really, really important to realise. And politicians, glad to see, on the whole, don't take account of this because it's politically extraordinarily unpopular.
Can I just add one word as we go through? Alan wants to add another point. Actually, two. When Tony and I were doing the study for you for UNAIDS on the relationship between HIV and the military, it was an interesting task, an interesting exercise, and the report has had a very interesting reception. And one of the reasons that it was interesting, and I use the word repeatedly, was that what we did not say in the report was that everybody had done absolutely everything brilliantly, and many people found that really hard to take, because there's now a working assumption that as soon as you report on anything that's been done by an international agency, then by definition you have to say it was all wonderful. It wasn't that we said that anything was terrible. What we pointed to is a point that's been repeatedly made this evening, which is that this is an area which is filled with enormous areas of ignorance, just straightforward ignorance, which leads to the second point, which is that another quality of long-wave events, it's as true, by the way, of climate change as it is of this, is that typically when it becomes a political issue, it is seen as a real and present danger, because that's the only way that contemporary democratic politics responds to things, and actions will be taken. But it is frequently, as we now discover, the case that the action which looks as though it's ostensibly the right thing to do in the short term may have a long-term consequence that's quite different and opposite. And in this particular area, the morally difficult area to deal with is that the acceleration of the release of antiretrovirals has an absolutely predictable consequence, because they're very arduous drugs to use, you have to have high compliance, which is that you increase resistance. Now, we're seeing that.
it's to be expected. But trading off the balance between what you do in the short term and what the right thing to do in the long term, as my colleagues are pointing out, is extremely difficult to do. Do you want to add one other
thing? I want to add one other thing, because I'm aware the time is running. Yeah. And that is that one of the very interesting things, and I speak now particularly to the students in the audience, is you have no idea how badly decisions are made in this world. I mean, you think that people know, but they don't. And they make decisions on the basis of the most inadequate information, and this is something which I've learned. And then the other thing that happens in this world, which is rather troubling, is that a whim, which is passed down from the head of an agency, which says, oh, let's find out about so-and-so, gets passed down as instructions until some poor bloody intern ends up reading tens of documents and coming up with an answer which he's forgotten he already asked the question. And parliamentary questions, by the way, do the same thing. They distract from some of the things that need to be done because they take people, because we take them very seriously, and indeed they should be. But I think that what we need to do is understand how little information decisions are made of and how much of a distraction questions and whims can come from the heads of organisations. And of course the other problem is that there are gatekeepers looking after the Peter Pios of this world, the Kofi Annans and so on and so forth. And what they do is they try to filter the questions that go through and try to make policy, because that's actually where their power lies. It's a difficult world we live in.
So you see, what the youngest member of the panel is actually saying is that you should shut up, sit down, and have a long period of reflection before saying anything.
No, what he's actually saying is that master students whose first job is to do that kind of thing need to act, in the words of Max Weber, as though their eternal soul depended on the interpretation of the data which they're dealing with, even if they're under pressure from some
That's
very senior
person. That's a philosophical answer. Now, the lady patiently waiting up above.
Hi.
Hello.
You mentioned the measures that we could undertake to help solve this problem of AIDS. For example, developing antiretroviral drugs. And recently, with this happening, patents are being considered. Evidently, governments and world leaders have some responsibility to treat AIDS. And can this be extended to controlling or even removing or preventing patents on antiretroviral drugs?
Well, I think the whole issue of the TRIPS agreement and the way that the patents are manipulated is very complex. I think one of the issues is that right now the pharmaceutical companies have lowered their prices in the face of competition from generics. The next big battle is for the next lines of drug treatment. But actually, the real issue here has to do with dealing with the effects of rolling out antiretroviral treatments imperfectly, and the issue of, as Gwyn has pointed to, of developing viral resistance. So I think that you're right, but I don't know what the answer is to dealing with the whole patent issue. But there's another issue down the line which we need to be thinking about instead of getting just hung up on the patent issue.
Thanks very much. Now we have two more questions, and I think we're going to have to call it a day. Lady at the back, and then gentlemen.
Hi, I'm a master's student here at LSE.
How's your immortal soul?
Oh, attaining the fate of Tony Barnett.
Right.
My question has to do with the flow of international knowledge. And there's a man out of the South Center named Branislav Gospic who writes a lot about global intellectual hegemony. And my question is, to what extent are universities like the LSE and universities in America taking what are considered the upper echelons of students from developing countries in Southern Africa, in East Asia, in Latin America, and kind of turning them into these policymakers that are doing a lot of policy work with not a lot of connection to the ground? And in what ways is that affecting the sustainability of treatment of long-term diseases in the places that they come from in developing countries?
You're the one that's doing it.
Well, you might like to have
he's going to say not guilty. Come on.
No, I think that the whole global system of education does can be seen as doing precisely that.
I think it rather depends on what kind of critical thinking is taught within any particular syllabus, regardless of which particular discipline you're going for. Now, one of the problems is that with increasing levels of professionalisation and assessment of performance, there is a tendency to narrow criteria of what achievement is in teaching, and students who are paying the kinds of fees that you folk pay here are expecting to get not necessarily critical thinking, but probably lots of knowledge. So there's an issue about what kinds of expectations people come with. There's a problem, and I don't know what the answer is.
Thanks.
Last question.
Thank you. Justin Parker, London School of Hygiene. Not to at all detract from Alan's call for earlier and more widespread sexual education, but one of the speakers at the back, one of the questions at the back, pointed to the fact that a lot of young or old people in Africa are very well educated, know about HIV, know how it spreads, and know how to prevent it, and yet it doesn't affect behavior. And I think, as many times, Tony, you as well, hinted at, education itself does not shape behavior. We know this. Simply telling somebody something does not shape, especially sexual behavior. We know that it's rooted in the social, economic, and political realities of life on the ground in very specific contexts. We seem to know that that means we have to deal with structural factors affecting behavior more than just going out and telling people messages, telling them what to do. My question for either of you is really, do you think we have any good conceptualization of how to engage with those structural factors, what it entails, and do you see any examples of it happening on any sort of scale?
I guess that's not fair because we've written together, but I can actually say
that. I can't control them.
I know. But there is a really interesting point here. Very recently, two major funding agencies in this field put out a call for tenders. And one of the things, DFID was one of them, and the ESRC was another one. And very interestingly, one of the projects that they turned down, because I was involved in it, so I know about this, was precisely an intervention using microfinance to improve the choices which women in parts of southern Africa, South Africa, have as a way of trying to reduce the rates of HIV transmission along with rates of domestic violence. It's interesting the kinds of things that funders put their money into, isn't it? So I think there are definitely some known interventions which seem to be promising as structural interventions. I don't think we have any conclusive examples.
I think that what we need to do is to be imaginative. And the microfinance project, which Tony refers to, is an imaginative one. It's about development. It's about equitable development. It's about gender-sensitive development. It's happening in South Africa, which is quite remarkable to talk about gender-sensitive development. But it is. So I think that's the sort of area where you can look. But there are other things we can do. One of the things that came out of the meeting that Tony and I co-facilitated is something which won't have an effect for 20 years. But why don't we go for opt-out routine offer of male circumcision when births are attended? Why don't we simply make it routine that when a male child is delivered, the mother gets offered the opportunity to have that child circumcised, provided it's being done by trained people? You know, that would have a huge impact on HIV, but it's 20 years from now that you'll have that impact.
But it's long-term thinking.
And that is one of the recommendations. Now, why can't we get that at UNGAS, by the way? Opt-out routine male infant circumcision.
Yep, Hilary Benn.
Yes, is he going?
Who's going?
No, I don't think the Benn gets literally.
Infant when infant.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a fascinating evening, and thank you all for such excellent questions. I can confirm, since nobody had the temerity to ask, that I was not 16 years old when I taught Alan. I was 18, and he was in my third form. And I am younger than Professor Barnett, although I did start working on AIDS in 1972. But thank you all very much
indeed. 1972. And remember, there are books outside.
Oh, and... yes... remember, 20% off. You'll never get this offer repeated. Thanks all very much for coming.
Thank you, Gwen.
Sorry.